ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's Wednesday, the 5th of November. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, New Yorkers turn out in the biggest numbers since 2001 to elect a new mayor. And arise Sir Bex, English football legend David Beckham, knighted at long last.
To receive the honour of knighthood, Sir David Beckham.
I realised very early on, quite a young age, that people listen to me because of my career and the teams that I've played for. And when you have a voice, you can make change.
The head of Australia's spy agency has issued a stark warning on national security. ASIO boss Mike Burgess says there are foreign powers that are both willing and capable of assassinating dissidents on Australian soil. So which countries are likely to pose such a threat, and what can Australian authorities do about it? Here's Bridget Fitzgerald.
The warning from the nation's top spy is clear. Complacency is not an option.
Australia is an island, but we are not isolated. The tyranny of distance does not make tyranny distant.
Mike Burgess, the Director General of the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation, or ASIO, used the 2025 Lowy lecture to warn that Australia is facing an unprecedented threat from hostile foreign governments seeking to undermine social cohesion, including what he described as high harm operations.
ASIO assesses there is a realistic possibility a foreign government will attempt to assassinate a perceived dissident in Australia. This threat is real. We believe there are at least three nations willing and capable of conducting lethal targeting here.
While Mike Burgess didn't specify which countries posed such a threat, Chris Taylor, the head of the Statecraft and Intelligence Policy Centre at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, says there are several countries that use assassination as a tool.
They are countries like Iran. They are countries like Russia, which has a record of assassinating dissidents and people it sees as adversaries overseas. It includes India. We've seen allegations raised against India in North America, in both Canada and the United States, in terms of actual and planned assassinations there. We've seen Israel use that as a tool of policy against its adversaries overseas. And we've seen places like North Korea also use that.
Mike Burgess warned that some nations wanted to weaponise so-called fault lines in society, pointing to the plot by Iran to hire local criminals to carry out attacks on Australia's Jewish community, which resulted in the expulsion of Iran's ambassador. Chris Taylor says addressing broad issues like social cohesion is important, and working with potential targets of espionage.
Often diaspora communities in Australia are kind of at the real forefront of activities like foreign interference directed against Australia. They're the ones who are suffering in the first instance. They're the ones who are targeted by foreign governments. So working closely with them, understanding their concerns, being receptive to what they have to say is a real starting point for being able to effectively address those threats, both in an intelligence sense and also in a broader policy sense as well.
So, for example, if a member of an expat community said something like, I believe I'm being followed, or I believe that someone is tracking my movements, that taking that as a serious threat would be important.
Absolutely. That's a critical first step.
There are a number of global examples of assassinations and attempted assassinations in recent years. For example, Canada accused India of carrying out the killing of a prominent Canadian Sikh leader, Hardeep Singh Nijjar, who was shot dead outside a temple in a suburb of Vancouver in 2023. Dr. Syra Bano is an assistant professor at Thompson Rivers University in British Columbia and a security expert.
Like, I was shocked to hear that because, you know, this is something you expect from authoritarian regimes, authoritarian countries, but you do not expect it from your fellow democratic countries.
There's a trial currently underway in Manhattan over the alleged assassination in which US prosecutors are attempting to prove that the Indian government did play a role. Dr. Bano says while Mr. Nijjar's death has reinforced the risk Canada may face from foreign actors, there's also been a focus on maintaining diplomatic dialogue with potentially hostile governments, including India. She notes a recent meeting between Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney and India's leader Narendra Modi at the G7 summit in Canada.
Since India has diaspora in Canada and in Australia, so that should be a strength in relations rather than a liability. So soft diplomacy and coming out with solutions where you are going to understand each other's concerns and you are going to address each other's concerns is going to lead us to have a longer and stable relations.
Dr. Saira Bano from Thompson Rivers University in British Columbia, ending that report by Bridget Fitzgerald. New Yorkers have turned out in the biggest numbers since 2001 to vote for a new mayor. The favourite is Ugandan-born Muslim Zoran Mamdani, a socialist at odds with the politics of another famous New Yorker, President Donald Trump. The contest could reshape long-standing power structures in the famous financial capital surrounding Wall Street. North America correspondent Carrington Clark joined me a short time ago from New York. Carrington, how has this campaign been fought, particularly by the favourite, Zoran Mamdani?
Yeah, you're going to have to excuse me if you hear some background noise. We're actually at one of the official watch parties. And you can see this very energised, very young, very diverse group. And this is really how Zoran Mamdani has run this race. He's tried to reach out to groups that he says have been previously ignored by the political elites. And if that sounds familiar, there are many things that he has taken from the Donald Trump playbook, although he's coming from the far left. And he is promising a complete shakeup of the way the government functions here in New York City, which is really the epitome of capitalism within the United States. He wants to expand drastically the social safety net, and that's by putting greater tax burden on the very wealthy here in this city, in order to pay for services like free childcare, like free public transport, even government-run grocery stores. And it seems to be a message that's resonated. Every time he's had an opportunity to talk about cost of living pressures, that's exactly what he's done. And another big issue, which would be familiar to Australians, is housing in New York City. It's a very expensive city in many ways, but it is really housing that seems to have become one of the real sore points for the populace. And he's planning on doing what he can as far as rent controls are concerned. And obviously, this is seeing accusations that he's really running an almost very strong socialist or communist campaign, according to the US president.
Andrew Cuomo is also running, and as an independent, having lost the Democratic Party primary to Zoran Mamdani. What's his campaign been like?
Yeah, fascinating. This is a contest between two Democrats, although Mamdani calls himself a Democratic socialist. For many, Andrew Cuomo represents the status quo or the centrist wing of the Democratic Party. I mean, he left the governorship after a series of scandals, including accusations of sexual harassment. But he did fail to win the Democratic primary, and that's why he's running as an independent. He is trying to push back on Mamdani's claims that he can effectively make life cheaper for the people of New York. He says that Mamdani doesn't have the experience to run a city with the complexity and problems of New York. But at the moment, the polls would suggest that message isn't resonating. And he himself, in some ways, has suffered now from being so closely associated with the US President Donald Trump. Donald Trump has taken a keen interest in this race. New York is his home city, and he seems to be personally affronted that a person spouting socialist ideals like Mr. Mamdani is this close to becoming the mayor of the city. He says that he would prefer people back a bad Democrat in the form of Andrew Cuomo than a communist, which is how he's referring to Mr. Mamdani. But Donald Trump is not a popular person in New York City, and Andrew Cuomo has done what he could to distance himself from the president, even if he is receiving his endorsement.
Carrington, do we expect a result in the next few hours, or does this sort of process take days?
So even though New York follows a more similar voting system to what Australians are familiar with, a preferential or ranked choice voting, which can sometimes mean it takes longer to get the results, the polls would suggest, at the moment at least, that Mr. Mamdani is on track for a pretty clear victory, which means we are expecting a result pretty quickly.
Carrington Clark in New York City. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. Back home and in South Australia, scientists are pointing the finger at a little-known algal species for causing the state's devastating algal bloom. The bloom first surfaced in March this year, triggering a wave of marine animal and fish deaths, excessive sea foam and illness amongst swimmers. The scientists who made the discovery say it's an emerging international threat with unknown consequences in changing ocean conditions. Here's Rachel Mealy.
Since the algal bloom began in March, scientists have known brevetoxins were to blame, but until now they haven't known which algae was producing it. Professor Shauna Murray is from the University of Technology, Sydney. She says the breakthrough came after many hours in the laboratory.
It's a massive task. In fact, this has been incredibly fast because typically this type of research might take a few years to establish. And so we did it in just months rather than years. And that was because we set up a really, really big team and we all worked extremely hard on this, yeah.
A species of algae known as Carinia mikimotoi was the first to be identified within the bloom. But when surfers and swimmers who'd been in the water near Victor Harbour reported respiratory symptoms, Professor Murray's suspicions were raised.
The fact that there were people reporting respiratory symptoms was a sign that there might be something more. But then it was confirmed in early May when SASQAP, the South Australian Shellfish Quality Assurance Program, identified brevetoxins as being present in shellfish. So then we certainly knew that we were looking for a different Carinia species in this bloom.
The team studied water and algae samples from dozens of sites along the South Australian coastline from March to September. They found a species called Carinia cristata kept turning up.
Generally, across the entire period, Carinia cristata was the dominant one, but some of the other species were dominant at different times in different locations.
She says it's not known if Carinia cristata has only just been introduced to South Australian waters or if it's been there all along.
We can't answer that question because we didn't investigate whether or not it was there 5, 10, 20, 50 years ago, because to investigate that, it's that type of really basic marine biodiversity research that's really not done in Australia very often or at all.
The research still needs peer review, but it's given hope to the South Australian task force in charge of addressing the disaster. Mike Steer is the head of that task force.
If we can develop rapid PCR tests to get an indication of what's in the water, that'll give us better information into the future to be more prepared in the event that we have another bloom. You know, so say for example, we test the water and are using PCR and we detect cristata or other species of interest. That gives us an early warning to then, inform industry to say, hey, this is on our doorstep. You might want to change your management practices accordingly.
Task Force Head Mike Steer, ending that report by Rachel Mealy and Caroline Horn. Streaming platforms like Netflix, Disney Plus and Amazon Prime have long enjoyed the attention of and revenue from Australian viewers like you. But has it come at the cost of the Australian screen industry? A lack of regulation in the sector has meant there's been no guarantee of seeing Australian stories in streamed content. But that is about to change, as Tanya Dendrenos reports.
How come you hate her so much?
Because she sucked Dad right in, that's why. You wait and see, she's bad news.
Like many Australian actors, Brooke Satchwell's career started on Ramsay Street.
I first entered the industry as a school kid off the school bus in the mid-90s, and this was as the internet was being built, when perhaps there was a little more cash to splash and we had a relatively strong representation of Australian stories and voices on our screens.
She's been working in the Australian screen industry for 3 decades now.
What are we going to do, Jamie?
There's definitely been periods as the landscape has shifted and changed with the advent of digital streaming, along with a disruption to funding cycles that definitely upset the rhythm of any kind of reliability in our industry.
Brooke Satchwell says that's not only had an impact on actors and producers, but a myriad of other jobs like chefs, builders and costume designers who support the industry.
We're just the screen that reflects our society back, and we want to have the capacity to show that in its kaleidoscopic glory and hold spaces for all stories that need to be discussed. We're suffering for the lack of investment, as all industry does. When it's not invested in properly, it can't grow in a healthy way.
For years, the industry has lobbied for regulation in the streaming space to implement rules around local content. Tomorrow, the federal government will introduce that legislation to Parliament. Australian writer and director Bruce Beresford says he's for anything that helps Australian production.
We are Australians, about 26 million of us. We want to hear Australian stories, and this legislation is essential.
The legislation will mandate that any streaming service with more than a million Australian subscribers will need to invest at least 10% of their total Australian expenditure or 7.5% of their revenue on Australian content. Arts Minister Tony Burke said in a statement there are Australian content requirements on free-to-air television and pay television, but until now there has been no guarantee that we could see our own stories on streaming services. Matthew Diener is the CEO of Screen Producers Australia.
There's going to be things we know that people aren't going to be happy about in the legislation. There's things that we think maybe will be happy in the legislation. So we've got to go through the process once we see the full detail of the bill. But we're really delighted that after however many years of campaigning, we've finally arrived.
How difficult has it been to operate in a space where there isn't regulation on streaming for Australian content?
You know, the last, I'd say, 18 months, there's been a decline in investment from those global businesses. And I think for a couple of them, they haven't been active at all. So that's been really difficult for many people that don't have jobs at the moment, looking for the next gig, have been in development rather than production. And, you know, there is a sense of crisis that was building and is building.
He says the legislation is an important step, but it's not the only one.
There are many other pieces that need to be addressed by government, and that includes funding for the ABC and SBS and Screen Australia. It needs things like tax reform for offsets, but also money generally for our sector to sort of continue to be able to deliver the work it's doing. Streaming regulation is an important element, but it's one of a number of things we've got to get right in this kind of framework we're dealing with.
Matthew Diener from Screen Producers Australia, ending that report by Tanya Dendrinos. One of the country's largest food relief organisations is calling on the federal government to address what it calls a national food insecurity crisis. Foodbank operates hundreds of food relief programs to help feed those Australians who can't afford to eat. New statistics reveal a troubling snapshot of just how widespread this issue really is, prompting industry leaders to call for more funding to expand their services in hard-to-reach areas across Australia. Kathleen O'Connor reports.
Darwin resident Celeste knows what it's like to go hungry.
I have learned to live the days drinking coffee. There's some nights where you have toast or noodles.
She's a single mother of three, and to prioritise lunch for her small children, she relies on cheap groceries supplied by Foodbank in her local community.
Oh, it's my weekly lifesaver. Definitely. Just for the basic grocery staples. And the kids get, you know, their packed lunch and we get our afternoon tea and dinners.
There's millions of people just like Celeste who have experienced food insecurity in the past year, according to new statistics from one of Australia's largest food providers, Foodbank. The annual hunger report shows that one in three households are skipping meals, which is more than last year. Kylie Tink is the CEO of Foodbank.
That is concerning because we know the Australian federal government has tried to provide some relief to Australians generally over the course of the last 3 years. So what these numbers show us is that the relief they've tried to provide is not translating into food onto people's tables.
Foodbank also found middle-income households earning over $91,000 have been added to the food insecurity cohort. Renters, single parents and those living with a disability are also overrepresented in the statistics. One social worker in Perth regularly shops at her local food hub because her client finds it difficult to afford food on his income.
With his disability pension, it's very expensive to shop at the supermarket. So there's some things he wouldn't be able to get, things like your ice cream, even eggs, vegetables, the frozen vegetables, and then any meat.
Foodbank helps distribute groceries to communities in need through its food hubs, but it's not enough to keep up with the demand. Leonie Jane is the manager of a food hub in WA and says she's never been this busy.
It's people all the way from being homeless to being single people households, families with children, seniors. Just today, we've been out on the road to three different towns and we've seen customers that we've never seen before.
In New South Wales, Ash Castro runs a food assistance program called the Warrawong Residents Forum.
A lot of people weren't able to manage or deal with any of their mental health issues because their priority was actually getting something to eat that night. What we're worried about is that without it, what happens?
He says this service needs donations to keep going. Food Bank CEO Kylie Tink is in Canberra this week, encouraging the federal government to provide cash incentives for food producers to ship their unwanted food to charities like Food Bank to guarantee an ongoing supply for those who need it most.
This tax reform was something that prior to being elected as government, the ALP was broadly supportive of. Last term, it was a Liberal senator that moved a private member's bill to try and get it introduced. So to me, that says there should be bipartisan support around this reform, but for whatever reason, the government is yet to actually proceed.
Federal Assistant Minister for Competition, Charities and Treasury, Andrew Leigh, says grant assistance for the food relief charity sector is ongoing, and this is the most efficient mechanism for providing quality food to vulnerable Australians.
Kathleen O'Connor there. He bent a knee. Like only he can, British football great David Beckham has finally received his knighthood. A rising Sir David, the former English football captain, was knighted by King Charles in Windsor Castle for his philanthropic work and contribution to sport. Standing alongside his fashion and music star wife, the now Lady Beckham. Here's Kimberly Price.
To receive the honour of knighthood, Sir David Beckham.
It was a crowning achievement for one of the United Kingdom's most celebrated subjects.
For services to sport and to charity.
The son of a hairdresser and kitchen fitter, Sir David grew up in East London dreaming of playing football for his country.
Growing up in Leytonstone, moving to Manchester and now stood here at Windsor Castle with His Majesty the King. Giving me a knighthood is something that I could never have imagined happening to me.
Supported by his designer and pop star wife, now known as Lady Beckham, Sir David, visibly moved, spoke of his deep patriotism.
And I've always flown our flag wherever I've lived, wherever I've gone, and I'll continue to do that.
Oh! That is absolutely phenomenal! What an astonishing goal by David Beckham!
The 50-year-old's football accolades are well documented, having pulled on the boots for England 115 times and played at top-tier competitions around the world before retiring in 2013. Sir David has also been a UNICEF ambassador since 2005 and last year became an ambassador for the King's Foundation supporting children's education.
I realised very early on, quite a young age, that, you know, people listen to me. And people listen to me because of my career. And when you have a voice, you can make change. And it's lucky that I get to work with so many amazing children, and you want to make change for them.
The football great has been eligible for knighthood since 2011 and made no secret of his desire to join the exclusive order, becoming embroiled in controversy in 2017 after labelling the selection committee unappreciative after missing out on that year's honour. On the streets of London, there were plenty of warm wishes.
I think he's a lovely guy. He's worked very hard for it, done charities, very good charity work for it.
I like him. I think he's a family man. So why not? He's done a lot for charity. I know he earns lots, but I think he does good. So, yes, good for him.
I mean, he's been a football legend for years, deserves it. He's been a great man from what I can tell. So for anyone, I think he's best fit for it.
Wen Lee Ma is the culture editor of The Nightly, who says Sir David's influence stretches well beyond sport.
You may have heard about his left foot, but also he is just a massive cultural ambassador for the UK. I also don't think that he would have gotten this honour without having married Victoria Adams, Posh Spice, because it really is the force of the two of them as a couple and as a family that I think has made him so culturally relevant.
While Sir David is not thought of as posh, she says his down-to-earth nature has made him a leader in his country.
He is this, like, very wholesome figure. He's a father of four. He's also a massive royalist. I mean, I think we all remember when he stood in line for 12 hours to, you know, pay his respects to the late Queen Elizabeth upon her death. when you think, do they deserve whatever that word means to be knighted? You're like, yeah, he kind of fits the bill.
He certainly does. Culture critic Wenli Ma, ending that report by Kimberly Price. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. He's the polar opposite to Donald Trump. A young Muslim, political novice, and democratic socialist is tracking to become the next mayor of New York City. Today, Jeff Kabasevis from the centre-right think tank, the Niskanen Centre, on how Zoran Mamdani managed to capture the attention of New York voters. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.